Hog Road manager, who came to fill in Friends with Warren Haynes in 1999 at age 25. He went to work for Weir in 2005 with the blessing of the Leshes and remained one of the few insiders who stayed on good terms with everybody. Jorstad had to rely on Bush and Jill Lesh. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but he knew better than to tell Kreutzmann. Jill took her responsibilities seriously. As the tour neared the end, she became enraged at Stephanie Scamardo, Warren Haynes' wife and manager, on stage at Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View during soundcheck. Her beef was about the attention Haynes was getting on stage. She attacked Scamardo, criticizing her husband for taking too much prominence. She then dismissed Haynes as hired help. Scamardo, not a timid woman herself, refused to back down as the two women got into it in full view of band and crew. Backstage, Jill wouldn't stop. She had decided that her contributions to the tour should be compensated, even though the band had decided not to pay managers. She confronted Jorstad over money, demanding a commission for the management work she had done on the tour. "The drummers don't bring anything to the table," she said. "They have to pay." Fearful of Kreutzmann's reaction if he ever discovered Jill Lesh had assumed anything resembling official duties on his watch, Jorstad counseled her to drop the matter. She would not hear of it. Jorstad even pointed out that she and her husband would be paying a quarter of the fee to her out of their own take, and that wouldn't be worth the trouble it would cause. Still, Jill Lesh was determined to extract a fee from the band. The Shoreline show was highlighted by a troupe of fire dancers from Kauai, friends of Kreutzmann, who lit up the traditional drum-slash-space interlude with fiery acrobatics that linked the Dead's underground roots to the modern-day Burning Man culture. Weir squirmed in the wings. "Is this what we've become?" he muttered to Jorstad. Lesh also hated the display, but Hart thought it was sensational, and Kreutzmann was only sorry his friends didn't play every show on the tour. Of course, the ongoing musical tension between Lesh and the two drummers carried into their relationship offstage. Band members were not speaking, and the Leshes had turned against the drummers, especially Kreutzmann. Many years before, in a drunken moment, Kreutzmann had squeezed Jill Lesh's breasts backstage. The incident had never been forgotten or forgiven. Lesh was not happy with Kreutzmann's playing. He even secretly kept Molo on call throughout the tour in case there was an opportunity to use him. Lesh approached a startled and appalled Mickey Hart before the tour's final show at the Gorge Amphitheater outside Seattle about substituting Molo for Kreutzmann. The answer was a firm, resolute no, but Lesh was not someone to take no for an answer. One big money date remained on the calendar. The 4th of July at the Rothbury Music Festival in Western Michigan. The band was scheduled to receive $2.5 million for a headline performance with a bonus based on ticket sales. When Jill Lesh discovered the promoters had opened a third gate for tickets not shown on the manifest, she held back the band from taking the stage until the promoters agreed to pay the full amount they owed. With Jorstad not on the trip, she acted as manager. The show started a half hour late. Instead of that making her a hero with Kreutzmann, he was furious that she would get involved and thought taking the stage late was disrespectful to the fans. Kreutzmann simmered with anger and frustration. Chapter 15. Further. The band members arrived at Tim Jorstad's office in downtown San Rafael for the final settlement conference after the tour. It had been successful, and as much as $1 million in residual funds needed to be distributed. Jorstad, who managed the tour, something he had never done before, had also represented some of the members as accountant and financial advisor for years, acting as Kreutzmann's proxy for the GDP board when Kreutzmann was in Hawaii. Although he was financial consultant to other Marin County rock stars, such as Carlos Santana and Grace Slick, Jorstad was no hippie. He was a small-town boy who graduated from the University of Northern Colorado and had owned his own bank, a straight-laced financial consultant. He was not accustomed to the rough-and-ready rock-and-roll world of the Dead, or the complicated personal relationships that extended back more than 40 years. He had attended many performances by his clients over the years, and enjoyed concerts as much as anyone, but Jorstad had never gone out on the road with his acts before. The experience on this tour had been revelatory, to say the least. No longer were the sales and revenues simply figures on a page. Now he was conducting nightly settlements and paying out crew expenses. In addition, he was constantly negotiating among band members who could no longer communicate among themselves. Even with his hourly fees soaring, he felt compelled to stay on the road for fear that without him the tour would fall apart. When the tour ended, he was relieved. Jorstad had witnessed many dire scenes in client meetings over divorces and other financial hardships over the years, but nothing had prepared him for dealing with the Dead. In August 2009, after playing the final one-off 4th of July date at the Rothbury Music Festival, all four members of the band presented themselves in Jorstad's office. Jorstad knew that the Leshes were still pissed off at the drummers and planning to extract their pound of flesh via a commission for Jill. Phil and Jill had taken him to lunch and ranted the entire meal over their perceived injustices. Jorstad was clear they were not going to let the matter drop. Finally, before the meeting, he told Hart and Kreutzmann about the Leshes' demands. Kreutzmann exploded at Jorstad for keeping him in the dark about Jill's work on the road, and raged that the Leshes thought they could hold up the band for a commission at the end of the tour. In Jorstad's office, with the four members, all the frustration, all the veiled resentments, all the years of being lashed together erupted, and Kreutzmann went off like a geyser. The furious drummer leveled his accusations at Jorstad before turning his attention to Lesh, whose haughty response caused Kreutzmann to explode out of his chair and go for Lesh with his hands. Lesh was no match for the enraged bull, but Kreutzmann was quickly pulled off. He sputtered in anger at Lesh. "I never want to see you again," he said. "I never want to play with you again. I don't want to have anything to do with you." Then Kreutzmann stormed out and, once again, closed the door on the Dead. Lesh, on the other hand, was fine with that. He saw a future without the drummers. He moved quickly behind the scenes with Weir, taking a cutthroat approach to relations in the band, harsh by even his standards. For Lesh, this day had been a long time coming. Weir sounded sheepish on the telephone, talking to John Scher, who had co-managed Weir with Cameron Sears since Garcia died. "I did something last night you're not going to like," he told Scher. Weir explained that he and Natasha had spent the evening before dining with Phil and Jill and got knee-crawling drunk. Vegetarian Lesh had stopped drinking many years before and only sneaked occasional puffs of pot out of the purview of his vigilant wife, so this was quite the occasion. Lesh made Weir a proposal. He suggested they combine forces in a new band. He explained to Weir the financial reality. It would take a whole bunch of Rat Dog shows to earn the same amount he would in a single show if they played together. Without the pesky drummers slash partners, they could have a better band, play before bigger audiences, and keep a larger share of the greater spoils. Weir, who was certainly attracted by the money and the crowds, was also still angry with the drummers from the tour. He could remember specific moments like car crashes during ballads he thought the drummers ruined with their overplaying. In a weak moment, without considering the full ramifications of his decision, he said yes to Lesh. There would, however, be conditions. Weir would have to dissolve Rat Dog and jettison his current management. Jill and Rat Dog road manager Matt Bush would handle the new band, and Lesh's booking agent, Jonathan Levine, would represent the act. While it might be possible to save some of his people's jobs under the new conditions, Weir was going to have to fire Scher and Sears, two longtime, close personal associates. Scher began producing Grateful Dead concerts on the East Coast more than 30 years before. Garcia called him their Jewish cousin in New York. With Sears, it was even more complicated. Not only had Sears handled all of Weir's business since Garcia died, his wife was Cassidy Law, daughter of longtime Grateful Dead staffer Eileen Law. Cassidy happened to be born in Weir's bed. The same night, he wrote the song Cassidy. He was thinking both about the newborn girl Cassidy, whose mother had already decided on the name from the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Neil Cassidy, the bull goose loony of the Merry Pranksters, Weir's one-time roommate and a major figure in dead circles, whose dead body had been found that same day in Mexico. That night was an electric storm of emotion and events in Mill Valley. Weir deeded a portion of the song's copyright to the baby, who grew up like a stepdaughter to him. This cut was going to sacrifice tissue. As for Hart, Weir called him and gave him the news regretfully. Lesch had approached Hart about going out without Kreutzmann, but Hart's refusal had been absolute. He would not betray his brother. Weir extended the possibility that once he and Lesch went out on the road, Weir could work on Lesch, soften his attitude. Hart remained unconvinced. He was mystified that Lesch and Weir had cut him out. "You're collateral damage," Weir told him. Lesch and Weir laid plans and quickly assembled their band. Jay Lane from Rat Dog joined Joe Russo, another young drummer known in jam band circles for the Benevento-Russo duo. Phil and Friends regular Molo was unavailable due to a long-term commitment with Roger McNamee's new band, Moon Alice. Jeff Comenti from Rat Dog and the Other Ones and the Dead took the keyboard spot. Guitarist John Kadlicek was a telling pick for the Garcia chair. His band, the Dark Star Orchestra, specialized in performing entire Grateful Dead concerts from the band's history, playing the same songs in the same order. Kadlicek could be scholarly in his efforts at recreating Garcia's sound in exact detail. He was known as Fake Jerry, and he would go so far as to adjust his amplifiers and other equipment to the period for the show being played. Formed in Chicago in 1997, Dark Star Orchestra were anointed in a late-night jam at a small Chicago club with Phish members Mike Gordon and John Fishman just prior to DSO's first anniversary. In the wake of Garcia's death, the band quickly became known as the leading Dead tribute band, playing as many as 200 shows a year, polishing their cunning recreation. In 2008, DSO played 150 shows. Given his oft-expressed displeasure with the tribute bands, Lesch's pick of Kadlicek to join his new band served two purposes. It effectively crippled the top tribute band by taking their guitarist, and it signaled Lesch's intent to tool his new band into the ultimate Grateful Dead tribute band. Playing with a Fake Jerry would have been the last thing any of the Dead musicians would have considered in the wake of Garcia's death. Anything but that. The musicians were assembled at Weir's San Rafael studios. They were not told anything about a new band. They were simply invited to jam with an eye toward performing a benefit concert together at the end of the month. After the third day, the musicians were informed that they were starting a band. They met for dinner at the Lesch's home the next night to talk about a name. That was settled early on by Weir. "How about Further?" he said. On September 18th, about a month after the fractious meeting at Jorstad's office, Further made the band's debut in Three Nights at the Fox, Oakland, a Gilded Age movie palace whose multi-million dollar restoration was the cornerstone project of a downtown Oakland redevelopment. The ornate 2,800-seat hall had only opened for concerts a few months before, and Further's opening weekend qualified as something of an event in Dead circles, given the band practically dropped out of the sky. The Deadheads knew nothing of backstage infighting. To most of the fans at the Fox, Oakland, this was Phil and Bobby with DSO. The show started with a trifling 8-minute jam between Weir and Lesch as the rest of the band stood by and watched. effectively isolating the axis on which Further would revolve before the entire band slammed into a hearty The Other One for the next 15 minutes. Cadlicic received a rousing welcome when he stepped to the mic to deliver his first Garcia vocal on Birdsong. In explaining the concept behind the surprise new band, Weir reached beyond the interpersonal issues, which he no doubt cared not to express. Once you add Mickey and Billy to the mix, and this is more real than one might imagine, you add a layer of expectation, Weir told Relics magazine. A lot of folks in the audience are looking for a walk down memory lane, and they're disappointed if they don't get that. That's cumbersome. So Phil and I decided to start fresh with the material and with an outfit that didn't carry those expectations. Lesh also explained the decision to break off from the drummers as a creative choice. One of the reasons that Bob and I wanted to go ahead with this band was to bring fresh approaches to the tunes, like he was doing with Rat Dog and I did with Phil and Friends, he told Relics. We treat it as repertoire. In Grateful Dead terms, that means every performance can be different. All versions of the songs are true, just like a fairy tale. In October, Lesh and Weir previewed the East Coast tour with a brief appearance at a VIP reception for an exhibit about the Grateful Dead in, of all places, the stately New York Historical Society, across the street from Central Park. About 300 donors and patrons milled in the upstairs hall, hung with giant antique paintings. Who knew we would ever be historic? Lesh told the crowd as he introduced his best friend and brother, Bob Weir, who arrived on the small stage, guitar in hand. The pair played a short set, beginning with a Dylan song undoubtedly selected for the surroundings, When I Paint My Masterpiece. Back home in Marin County in November, Further played a secret show at the tiny 19 Broadway in Fairfax, deep in the bowels of the county, announced only the day of the show. The live rehearsals continued in December with a quick swing through five East Coast small theaters and two nights at Mill Valley's 300-capacity Masonic Hall before ramping up to a full-scale two-night New Year's Eve run at the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco. In January 2010, Further announced the band would do a series of 10 consecutive shows at both the Masonic Hall and the 142 Throckmorton Theater. Deadheads swamped the elite enclave of Mill Valley, filling the quaint town square with panhandlers and camp followers, vans and campers, thoroughly disrupting the upscale community after the shows in December had caught the little town by surprise. But the invasion that accompanied the January run was something the burghers were entirely unprepared for. The redwood-covered town center was overrun with hippies, and not the bucolic, easygoing California brand, but the more seedy and contentious deadheads from the East Coast. Ticket sales were limited to one ticket per customer, and the press was barred from what was being advertised as live rehearsal sessions. Dozens of people waited in line all day on the sidewalks outside the halls. There were complaints of public urination. People were astonished to hear of a knife fight in the Throckmorton lobby. When the band announced the first extensive national tour for February, the two background vocalists, Zoe Ellis, younger sister of Rat Dog's Dave Ellis, and Sunshine Garcia Becker, no relation to the guitarist, who were both young mothers with infant children, begged off. Stellar road mother Jill Lesh swung into action, ordering a separate bus and a pair of nannies, and the girls signed back up. With all this youthful energy behind the grand old men of the dead, Further brought a new vitality to the music. Cadlicic slowly eased his way into his own personal style and away from a more exact recreation of Garcia solos. Chimenti, always among the most solid musicians on any bandstand, came into his own in this ensemble. Russo was a powerful, supple drummer, and Lane had become thoroughly schooled in the songbook through his years in Rat Dog. Lesh and Weir even introduced new material. Weir brought Ashes and Glass from Rat Dog. Lesh dusted off an old song Garcia started with David Crosby more than 30 years before called The Mountain Song, messed around with it himself before giving it to his younger son Brian to finish the lyrics. The Princeton undergrad also worked on lyrics with Robert Hunter for a piece of music by his dad called Welcome to the Dance that Further introduced as early as the initial Fox Oakland run. Further was fresh and confident right from the start. Lesh had taken all the lessons he learned from Phil and friends and put them to work. Plus, he had Weir with him. The Deadheads embraced Further immediately. Matt Bush, Weir's tour manager, and Jill Lesh shared duties comfortably backstage. Bush was calm, capable, and fair. The two camps, Lesh and Weir, did not mingle much. Weir and the Leshes alternated writing the set lists, and the loose duties of the band leader went with whoever wrote the sets that day. They set up backstage tents on opposite sides of the stage, and while Weir's was always party central, the Lesh tent was often empty and quiet. The brotherly dynamic between the two principals could shift suddenly from loving and harmonious to chilly and antagonistic without the other band members knowing what happened. At first, Weir was doing fine, enjoying himself, singing and playing great, holding court backstage endlessly. Lesh was bubbly, chipper, surprisingly energetic, although the crew whispered rumors attributing his stamina to anti-rejection steroids he took for his transplant. They also wondered if Jill didn't sometimes take the same drugs. The good vibes didn't last. Lesh's mercurial wife exploded all over the background vocalists after the next-to-last show on the tour in Colorado. The band had just finished one of the hottest shows they had ever played. Zoe Ellis's father had attended and watched from a strategic seat on the stage. Jill had taken a special interest in the two women vocalists from the start, and with her official duties largely handled by her competent partner, she focused extra attention on them. Then, following this exhausting and satisfying show, after weeks together on the road, Ellis found herself facing a livid Jill Lesh, who was furious over some minor misuse of a van and errand runner backstage. Jill further shocked Zoe by lashing into both her and Sunshine personally. "You are nobodies," she screamed at them. "Less than nobodies. All the years these guys have put in paying their dues. You have no right to speak to me like that," Ellis interrupted. "You don't know anything about what dues I've paid." Ellis quickly turned and left the room. She was hurt and deeply embarrassed to be spoken to that way in front of her daughter, even if she was an infant. She had to learn 23 songs in 2 days for the first show. While she had come to appreciate the music, especially Hunter's lyrics, she was no Deadhead like her singing partner Sunshine Becker. Further had been a fun, fairly well-paying job. She went home after the next concert and sent the Leshes the most polite, kindly letter of resignation she could write. As it happened, that first tour was also the end of the Further road for drummer Jay Lane. After 15 years of following Weir's leadership, he found himself relegated to a secondary role in a band where Weir also seemed relegated to a secondary role. Where he had been the sole driving force of Rat Dog, in Further, Lane was accenting and decorating Joe Russo's playing. He was the Mickey Hart of Further. Lane had no real complaints. He was playing a job any drummer in the world would want. But then Les Claypool called and said he wanted to put Primus back together. Now Lane faced a dilemma. He held long talks on the bus with Weir and came to the decision to leave Further, only informing Lesh the day before his final gig. Lesh posted a magnanimous adieu to Lane on his website. "Over the past year, Jill and I have come to know and love Jay for the great guy he is," Lesh wrote. He could not be replaced. Russo would remain the sole drummer of the band. Jeff Pearson was drafted to replace Zoe Ellis. He was one half of an acoustic folk-pop duo called Box Set, and he auditioned by singing a few Dead songs with Sunshine Becker at a local studio for Lesh and a few others. He got the nod, but was told there would be no rehearsal before the Memorial Day weekend date. Trial by fire, he was told. His future with the band would depend on his performance at that gig. Pearson passed the test. The Further Festival was an ambitious 3-day event that May, staged in Calaveras County Fairgrounds in Sleepy Angels Camp in the Sierra Nevada foothills. This was not the touring Further Festival that Cher and Sears had produced in the late 90s. Angels Camp had been the scene of an annual rock show in the 70s and 80s called Mountain Air Festival, and subsequent performances by both The Grateful Dead in 1987 and Phil and Friends in 1999. Not only did Further play note-for-note recitations of 6 full-length Grateful Dead albums over the 3 nights, but Larry Campbell and his wife, Teresa Williams, both Phil and Friends veterans, wrangled a 2nd, largely acoustic stage, where Campbell, Jackie Green, and others combined for a middle-of-the-night Phil and Friends mini-reunion. Campbell and his wife augmented Further prominently during acoustic-flavored Working Man's Dead and American Beauty segments of the program. Band members held question-and-answer sessions during the day in a room displaying old photos and memorabilia, including a giant blow-up photo of the Dead playing there. Other groups appearing over the weekend included Brian Lesh's band, Blue Light River, and Mark Caron's band, Jeremiah Puddleduck. While Weir and Lesh were launching Further, the drummers were not staying home crying in their bongs. Kreutzmann was involved in the most serious non-Dead musical project of his life, a New Orleans-oriented jam band called Seven Walkers, featuring guitarist-songwriter Papa Molly. As bassist for the New Orleans R&B instrumental group The Meters, Seven Walkers bassist George Porter was one of the most influential players in his field. Mississippi-born Malcolm Wellborn, who goes by the name Papa Molly, wrote the band's original material with lyrics from Robert Hunter, mixed at shows with old New Orleans R&B, Papa Molly originals, and, of course, a few Dead covers. Drummer Hart has never slowed down. From ancillary projects like an art exhibit of slices of bark from redwood trees he found on his morning walks around his Sonoma ranch, to a deep plunge into astrophysics with Nobel laureate George Smoot, manipulating sounds recorded from deep in space. Using UC Berkeley's supercomputer, Smoot and his team showed Hart waveforms millions of years old, and he turned them into sound files, sonifications, to use in recordings. Hart was literally playing with the Big Bang. Hart took time to write the score for a ballet by the Alonzo King Company. He was also putting together another edition of the Rhythm Devils, his percussion orchestra, this time featuring the young blues rock phenom from England, guitarist Davy Knowles of Backdoor Slam, and guitarist Keller Williams, headed out on tour in the spring. He and Kreutzmann were still drum brothers, a celebrated percussion team, and Kreutzmann rejoined the band for a handful of dates in the summer, including the Gathering of the Vibes Hippie Fest in Bridgeport, Connecticut, the night after Further played. Like ships passing in the night. Chapter 16. Crossroads. Lee Von Helm was a leathery survivor. In 1991, on his Woodstock, New York farm, his beloved barn and recording studio, along with all of his gear, burned to the ground in an electrical fire. He promptly rebuilt it. In 1998, he was diagnosed with throat cancer and advised to get a laryngectomy. He opted for 27 radiation treatments at Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York City, which killed the tumor but also destroyed his voice. After several years of writing notes and hoarse whispers, Helm regained his voice, but now he faced foreclosure on his rebuilt barn and home. In 2003, Helm decided to throw a rent party. He tabbed Larry Campbell and guitarist Jimmy Vivino of The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien to put together a hothouse band and began holding informal weekly gatherings called Midnight Rambles at his barn. Helm likened the affairs to the late-night sessions held by minstrel shows he attended as a youth in Arkansas. As drummer and vocalist with the band, Helm knew something about disputes over control of a storied rock band's legacy. He alone was the holdout when band guitarist Robbie Robertson purchased the other members' interests in their partnership. Helm and Robertson didn't speak for years. Long after The Last Waltz, the concert extravaganza film by Martin Scorsese that marked the group's retirement from touring, Helm continued to plow that field, leading various versions of the supposedly defunct group as long as he could. When keyboardist Richard Manuel hanged himself in a sleazy motel room after one more shitty gig in Florida in 1986, and bassist Rick Danko died in his sleep in 1999, Helm retreated to Woodstock, where his credit was always good at Vince's meat market. These rambles were distinctly low-key affairs. Campbell switched off between fiddle, mandolin, pedal steel, and guitar. His wife, Teresa Williams, sang in the band, and Helm's daughter, Amy Helm, played. The barn held 200 spectators, and tickets cost a whopping $100 apiece. But once Helm's friends like Elvis Costello, Emmylou Harris, and Dr. John started turning up, there was a line of cars from his place to the highway every Saturday night. In July 2010, the night after finishing a sold-out run at Nokia Theater in Times Square to culminate a successful six-week tour by Further, Phil Lesh and his family headed up to Woodstock to be guests at the Midnight Ramble. The Levon Helm studio sat atop a breathtaking vista of mountain greenery. The refurbished barn had the clean, wholesome air of a cabin in the woods. The intimate audience included actresses Jane Fonda and Catherine Keener, and Phish bassist Mike Gordon. Lesh was greeted with thunderous applause. "This is so cool," he said. "Thank you, Levon, for getting this together. Absolutely." With Phil and Friends veterans Campbell and his wife in the band, Lesh brought out his two sons, Graham and Brian, and dug into a set of Dead tunes like Deal, Direwolf, I Know You Rider, and Friend of the Devil, Lesh's seismic bass notes shaking the barn floor. Lesh and his son's harmonies lit up the songs. The boys showed off their guitar chops. Lesh glowed. He choked up introducing his sons to the crowd. "I have to say," he said, "this is the proudest moment of my life." During the Levon Helm band set, Lesh sat prominently behind Helm's drum kit and sang along to Deep Ellum Blues, a song the Grateful Dead also used to play. Donald Fagen of Steely Dan was playing keyboards, as he often did with the Helm band, and Lesh took up bass for a couple of Dead songs. Tennessee Jed was a song Helm recorded for his Grammy-winning 2007 comeback album on his own label, Dirt Farmer, after he got his voice mostly back. Shakedown Street was sung by Fagen, a great convergence considering the sleek, carefully manicured Steely Dan may have been the polar opposite of the Grateful Dead when both operations were at their peaks. Lesh also joined Campbell, Teresa Williams, and Amy Helm for the Dead's Addicts of My Life, and the entire Lesh clan chimed in on the finale of The Wait, Graham and Brian each tackling a verse. It was an evening Lesh would not soon forget. Further finished out the year with a triumphant headline performance at the Outside Lands Festival in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park in August, where the Grateful Dead once played for the Human Bee-In, and where the band and the Deadheads gathered after Garcia's death, as well as tours in September through the West Coast and November through the East, ending with two sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden. By the time Further celebrated New Year's Eve in a two-night run for the second year at the Bill Graham Civic in San Francisco, the band had done a massive 77 shows, not including 18 public rehearsals since the previous September. With Further, Lesh had taken complete charge of the legacy, in short order establishing the new band as the heirs to the throne and doing the roadwork to back up the claim. As the band swept through the markets, every nascent Deadhead in the nation bought a ticket. The old guard was slow to adopt Further, and young people barely out of diapers when Garcia died were discovering the music and joining up. While Weir relished the road so much, he would sometimes ride the bus home at the end of the tour, instead of flying to spend a couple of extra days out. Lesh had long hated the touring routine. At age 71, he felt the immense exhaustion of the first year of Further settle in mind, body, and spirit. The experience at Levon's midnight ramble had reignited thoughts in his mind, lying dormant since he abandoned the Terrapin Station Museum project 10 years before. In March 2010, the Leshes began talking publicly about buying the real estate where the Good Earth Organic and Natural Food Store stood in Fairfax. The popular grocery store was planning to move to a nearby vacant supermarket in the fall, and the Leshes eyed the property as a possible location for a barn of their own. Lesh posted a note about his intentions on his website. "We're taking the first steps to make a long-time dream, a permanent musical home, come true," he said. "Our goal is to create a vibrant community gathering place, beautiful, comfortable, welcoming, for members of the community to commingle and enjoy good music." He went on to say they would be purchasing a building that would be remodeled to feel like an old barn, and they would begin to present West Coast rambles. He indicated Helm had given his blessing to what Lesh was planning to call Terrapin Landing. Although he raised his family in the nearby upscale town of Ross, Lesh lived in Fairfax for many years before he was married, which is a small town with a mind of its own. Several miles up Sir Francis Drake Boulevard from San Rafael, Fairfax is the last town before the woods overtake the road. A long-time hippie outpost, the city only had one rock club through the 70s, the Sleeping Lady, an organic juice bar that served no alcohol and didn't allow smoking. Van Morrison had lived in town and even bought his parents a small record store in the strip of stores that passed for downtown Fairfax. Lesh knew he would have to ease on in. There would be a Fairfax-style collaboration between him and the neighborhood in order to work things out, the town's mayor told the Marin Independent Journal. In August, the Leshes filed a permit application for a different, adjacent piece of property. They changed their minds about the old market, checking out the location after closing one night and realizing the corner location would be a problem for a music club in a residential neighborhood. The new site was on the other side of the market, away from houses. "It's solidly on Drake, not on a residential corner," Joe Lesh said to the Marin Independent Journal. "The performance space will be concrete clad in wood, so it will be completely soundproof. You would not be able to hear anything outside. Obviously, we have to deal with parking and traffic and other issues, and that's what the use permit process is for. We have a lot of work to do to see if we can address all those concerns." The property was in escrow, pending permit approval, and plans called to tear down the old garage and build a 5,400-foot, two-story barn with a 2,800-foot performance space to be called the Great Room, openly modeled on the Helms place in Woodstock. Lesh had been converted by his visit to Helms' midnight ramble. "It was like going to church," he told the Marin Independent Journal. "I knew immediately that was something I wanted to do at home, to have a place like that. It's small enough and intimate enough that it gives the music more meaning." While Lesh's were consulting architects and contractors, Weir was up to his eyeballs into high-tech musical real estate development himself, having bought a huge corner building in a San Rafael industrial park, gutted the insides, and built a space-age recording studio designed to host webcasts like the world had never seen before. This was his new Tamalpais Research Institute, TRI Studios. Weir had a couple of investor partners, but he poured much of his own money into the project, where costs ran more than $3 million. It was a peculiar corner of an otherwise colorless and anonymous collection of warehouses and offices off the freeway. On the other side of the TRI wall was the chop shop where James Hetfield of Metallica worked on his hot rods. Across the street was a rehearsal hall and studio for Sammy Hagar, where the Red Rocker also parked his collection of Ferraris. Some guys, when they have a little success in life, they go out and buy a yacht or a fancy car, Weir told the Marin Independent Journal. "What I did was build a flying saucer." The main room of the 11,500-square-foot complex contained a Meyer sound constellation, a highly refined audio sound system advancement by the famed Berkeley speaker manufacturer John Meyer. The few constellations that Meyer had sold at that point had gone to classical music chamber orchestras and the like. Weir was his first customer in the rock-pop field. The room was dotted with as many as 80 small speakers and a couple of dozen microphones to further pick up and disperse sound. The entire system was designed to run through simple computer software that Weir could operate himself from an iPad on stage, bypassing the necessity of mixing engineers. At the touch of a finger, the room could sound like a cathedral or somebody's living room, a baseball stadium or a bathroom. The Constellation was a modern technological miracle. Clean, crisp, resonant audio that enveloped the listener without fatigue or strain, like being dipped in a river of sound. In addition to the futuristic audio, Weir and longtime dead soundman John Cutler stocked the room with all the toys they wanted, including massive amounts of server space to facilitate plans to support the investment in the studio through pay-per-view webcasts. Weir knew no such business model existed and that recording studios themselves were going out of business on practically a daily basis, but he was intent on testing his hypothesis. As Lesh had done, it was his way of trying to figure out a way to make music without touring. Even for road-loving Bobby Weir, 40 years was taking its toll. In May 2011, Weir held the first webcast at TRI the same week he finally appeared with the Marin Symphony Orchestra. Weir had agreed to appear in a fundraiser for the orchestra, but insisted they cede creative control. His vision turned into an elaborate and expensive event originally scheduled for 2010. Weir finally made the show in May 2011. He did an opening set backed by ex-Rat Dog musicians, including both Robin Sylvester on electric bass and Rob Wasserman on acoustic bass, with a quartet of the classical musicians playing some arrangements and, at Weir's impish insistence, a little ham-fisted improvising. For the second half of the concert, the full orchestra played elegantly realized symphonic arrangements of Grateful Dead songs, written by Stanford University composition instructor Giancarlo Aquilanti. To debut his webcast series a few days later, Weir recreated the concert's opening segment for the benefit of web viewers live from TRI Studios. If he was not busy enough, after a solo appearance at the Sundance Film Festival in February for the release of the dramatic film featuring a Grateful Dead soundtrack, The Music Never Stopped, Weir also announced his first ever solo tour, a handful of East Coast dates in August. In June, Weir brought further into TRI for a 2.5-hour webcast concert offered to pay-per-view subscribers for $19.95. Demand was great enough to crash the TRI servers, meaning many people couldn't sign on the site. The full webcast was posted as a continuous loop a couple of days later to make up for the technical problems people experienced. As this was a new technology, these kinds of bumps in the road had to be expected. It probably didn't help that nobody on the TRI staff had ever run a webcast before. In the meantime, Lesh was having his own problems getting his project greenlighted by the Fairfax City Council. The day before it was to be considered, Lesh pulled his permit approval from the agenda after being unnerved by signs posted strategically along the route of his morning walk, reading, "No terrapin, please." They must have done it in the middle of the night after watching where he walks, Jill Lesh told the Marin Independent Journal. It felt a little weird and creepy. Jill Lesh also told the paper that she and her husband were disturbed by anonymous opponents who put negative flyers on cars that were parked at St. Rita's Church in Fairfax during a child's funeral. The Leshes had proposed paying St. Rita's to use some of its parking during performances at their planned club. "We didn't want to start off this way," she said. "There are lots of other places we could go. We just really like Fairfax. We thought we could really do some things that would benefit the town." Weeks before the Leshes announced in November they were scrubbing the Fairfax project, they had already been meeting with city officials of San Rafael to check the lay of the land. Lesh had been reading the Bob Dylan memoir, Chronicles, and reminiscing with his wife. He took her on a drive past the band's old San Rafael rehearsal hall, Club Front, by the waterfront. We were having lunch in the area one afternoon and decided to take a drive by the old studio, Lesh recalled on his website. While we were driving around, we went by the Seafood Peddler, where Further did some rehearsal shows a couple years ago in their Palm Ballroom. We pulled into the rear parking lot, and we saw a large painted Grateful Dead Steal Your Face logo with the words, Buckle Up Kids, above it. We looked at each other, and both had the same flash, that the Seafood Peddler had the foundation for us to realize our long-held dream of finding a place in Marin County to make music. It was one of those wonderful moments in life when it all converges, and you can see the path that lies ahead. In January 2012, the Leshes announced they had purchased the Seafood Peddler, a landmark wharfside eatery with a trademark sign of a ship atop a flagpole, visible from the freeway. The longtime owner simply stepped aside and relocated his business when he heard the Leshes wanted to buy the spot. It was all too perfect. Lesh changed his plan for the name, having decided it was not a landing, but a new beginning. He called it Terrapin Crossroads. At almost the exact same time Lesh was announcing his new club in San Rafael, oddly enough, a few exits down the freeway, Weir was ballyhooing the reopening of a Mill Valley club in which he was an investor, the Sweetwater Music Hall. The minuscule 80-seat original club was the jewel of Marin County nightlife, a community center to the local rock crowd where Lesh and Weir staged the Crusader Rabbit Stealth Band comeback. After changing hands, a dispute with the landlords, and several years of not being open, a new set of investors acquired the name and pumped a cool $3 million into remodeling the 107-year-old Masonic Hall just off the town square. Weir supervised the installation of a pristine audio system from Meyer Sound Laboratories. If Lesh was going to build himself a playhouse, Weir had staked out some territory for himself at another playground down the way. For years, Sweetwater was the place many of us local and visiting musicians headed to when we were looking to play for fun, Weir told the Marin Independent Journal. Well, our clubhouse is back, and it belongs to all of us. Woohoo! Mill Valley finally has its playpen back. While the soft opening of Sweetwater in January 2012 featured the southern rock band The Outlaws, the initial calendar leaned heavily toward the Deadhead clientele that Lesh would also hope to attract, with bands featuring Mark Caron, Steve Kamak, and other Dead acolytes. Weir played the opening with Sammy Hagar and Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads, came back a couple of nights later to sit in with Steve Kamak, and then disappeared from public view for the next 6 weeks. Chapter 17. Capital. After 45 years, I'm done touring, Phil Lesh told the Marin Independent Journal. Eating a Phil's scramble of egg whites, avocado, scallions, cheddar cheese, and tomatoes off the brunch menu on the porch of his new San Rafael club, Terrapin Crossroads, a few weeks after the official March 2012 opening, Lesh surveyed his new domain and professed his satisfaction. This all came together in 6 weeks, he told the reporter, as Bob Dylan records played on the house sound system. It's astonishing after the debacle in Fairfax. A sign outside with the Dancing Turtles from the Terrapin Station album cover could be seen from the freeway. The interior had been paneled in vintage barn wood, and the walls were covered with photographs and memorabilia from the Dead. Upstairs was a quiet room full of overstuffed easy chairs and homey couches, and downstairs was another lounge across from the bar. Bands played free shows on a small stage in the bar. The big shows took place in the Great Room, the former ballroom adjacent to the main dining room, where the Lesh family could often be seen eating dinner together before a show. Lesh would make his way out of the dining room, shaking hands and exchanging pleasantries with his patrons. Jill Lesh was around the club nightly, overseeing details and running the staff. She could be capricious, once pulling Deadhead journalist Blair Jackson, who was more fan than critic, into her office at set break to berate him for not being more supportive of their efforts in the community. Although stung, Jackson, true to Deadhead form, returned to the hall to enjoy the second set. Club staff wore work shirts emblazoned with the Steely and slogan, "Buckle Up, Kids," from the graffiti the Leshes had first spied as an omen of the location's sustainability. Before the official opening, Lesh tried out both the club and a new rendition of Phil and Friends for one night in February before taking the band on weekend dates in Colorado. It was the first appearance of Phil and Friends since the formation of Further, a sign of Lesh's growing discontent with Further. Soon after, Terrapin Crossroads announced a 12-show run in March by Phil and Friends with tickets at $150 apiece. $300 VIP tickets were also available, setting off the inevitable protest squealing in Deadhead circles. The club's own website agreed the ticket prices were quite high. However, the site continued, "The reality of bringing a major rock show to an intimate venue is that tickets will cost a few bucks more than usual. It costs a lot to put on a big show in a small space. Rest assured, though, as we get rolling, there will be shows and ticket prices for all budgets. We don't want to exclude anyone from what we're building here." Prices notwithstanding, demand for VIP tickets crashed the club's computers as soon as tickets went on sale. The additional fee included food, drink, an exclusive tent, and a private after-show performance. All 12 shows sold out. Lesh used a revolving crew for the opening shows that included Phil and Friends veterans Jackie Green and Jimmy Herring, mixed with Further players like Jeff Comenti, John Cadlesick, Joe Russo, and others. Chris Robinson of the Black Crowes showed up. Larry Campbell and his wife, Teresa Williams, came in for the second weekend. Lesh's son Graham played on every show. Bob Weir joined in one night early in the run. In April, after a walloping 14-show East Coast tour by Further that included an 8-night run at New York's Beacon Theater, the band's longest residency to date, and co-headlining the Wani Festival in Florida with the Allman Brothers, Lesh presided over the reunion of The Q in 4 nights at Terrapin Crossroads. He was drawing from a pool of jam-minded younger musicians, such as Jackie Green's pal Tim Bloom of Mother Hips and his wife Nikki Bloom, or members of Ryan Adams' band, The Cardinals, or Railroad Earth. Lesh had discovered an array of willing participants in his experiments closer to the age of his son, Graham. Lesh himself played practically every night at the club during May and June, either in the 400-seat Great Room or in a free show at the smaller lounge. In May, he officially introduced what he called the West Coast Ramble, and dedicated not merely the series of performances, but his entire nightclub restaurant operation to Levon Helm, who had died from cancer the previous month. In New York, with Further in April, Lesh had phoned the hospital and spoke to Helm's daughter, Amy. At Terrapin, prior to performing a song-by-song rendition of the second album by the band, Lesh recalled visiting and performing at Helm's Midnight Ramble. "So much of our vision comes from there," Lesh said. "An intimate setting, collaboration with different musicians, multi-generationally friendly. It's safe to say that this place would not exist if not for Levon's example and encouragement. I'd like to dedicate not just the show or the next show or everything we do here, but the whole place to Levon Helm." If Lesh and Weir were building themselves clubhouses, they were also experimenting with building community, which had been the great lesson of the post-Garcia years. While the Sweetwater represented the return of a cherished Mill Valley institution and appealed to a broader cross-section of the community, which fit egalitarian Weir, the club certainly created a wide berth for the Deadheads. Lesh's place was more Dead-centric, or more specifically, Lesh-centric, and may have actually extended and promoted Dead culture. Most importantly, They both created spaces where community could develop. At his TRI studios, Weir was also dealing with community, trying to harness the power of the internet to support, or at least partly support, the Space Age studio through regular pay-per-view concerts on the web. He had remodeled the large building to his exact specifications. Longtime Dead engineer John Cutler and mad audio scientist John Meyer went to town building the most advanced studio in the world, capable of broadcasting heretofore impossible levels of video and audio quality on the internet. The million-dollar recording console was obtained at a substantial accommodation price after Weir traded a private performance with the company. In addition to two other smaller studios, the main room was 2,000 square feet and contained the miraculous Constellation sound system. This kind of technological experiment was in keeping with long-held Grateful Dead tradition. Almost alone among their peers, the Dead devoted large amounts of time and money to research and development. The band put their money where their sound equipment was. Grateful Dead audio innovations over the years have benefited many people besides the Dead, from the design of large public address systems to tiny hearing aids. The band's first resident audio wizard, Owsley Stanley, invented modern concert sound and monitor speakers for bands to hear themselves sing. The so-called wall of sound system the band developed in the early 70s was probably their most well-known experiment. A massive and complex network of speakers that took hundreds of man-hours to erect and take down. The wall proved to be impractical to the extreme, cost a ton of money, and only was in operation a short time. But the Dead learned lessons from the experience that informed all their future thinking. The Dead never earned a penny from their efforts, only better sound. In the grand Grateful Dead audio research style, Weir knew TRI was a gamble on the future, and he ran through all his own money before taking on partners. He never once penciled out the investment. In March, a free broadcast with The National, the Brooklyn-based alt-Americana band who brought along other musicians, introduced the TRI webcasts. The resulting performance was exactly what Weir had in mind. A meeting of like-minded musicians, drawing on each other's repertoires and styles to create something fresh in the moment. The National had requested My Brother Esau, a song Weir hadn't played since 1987. He and lyricist John Barlow fiddled with the lyrics in the days before the show. Weir also sang a National song, Daughter of the Soho Riots. The show ended with the entire studio audience standing around the musicians in the center of the room. There is no stage at TRI. While they sang around one microphone, Ripple, Uncle John's Band, and Broke Down Palace. Weir was again throwing himself into work. With Further increasingly dominated by the Leshes, and tension between them growing louder every show, he sought other outlets. The week after the TRI webcast with The National, he was back at Sweetwater, sitting in with Lucas Nelson, son of Willie, and his band, Promise of the Real. That weekend, he played two shows at the Fox Oakland with Bruce Hornsby, two solo sets capped by a duo performance. 2 days later, he left for the Further tour and stayed out after Further came home to do a round of solo dates on the East Coast. 3 weeks later, he was back out doing 9 dates in a trio with Chris Robinson and Jackie Green. While Weir was doing all this work, and Lesh spending most of his time in between Further tours at his Terrapin Crossroads, Mickey Hart was touring with his new Mickey Hart Band behind the release in April of a new album, Mysterium Tremendum, sizzling, smoldering, slow, fat grooves of electro-funk that featured exquisite new Robert Hunter songs, such as Slow Joe Rain. The carefully layered instrumental tracks contained large helpings of Hart's sonifications from the astrophysicists, sound waves he converted using sophisticated algorithms from data collected from planets, stars, entire galaxies. At the same time Hart was working out with Deadhead astrophysicists, he came together with Dr. Adam Ghazali of UCSF, a a pioneer in bridging neuroscience and technology. The neuroscientist wired him with electrodes and used him as a guinea pig slash research associate on serious explorations of the relationship between cognition and rhythm. With signals coming from wires attached to a cap Hart wore while he played drums, X-rays of his brain lit